Hey everybody, it's JT. What is on your holiday meal shopping list? Well, I would suggest Painted Hills Natural Beef. It is some of the best beef in the world. And your friends and family will be thanking you for a long time if you serve Painted Hills Natural Beef for your holiday meals. And now you can buy it online just by going to PaintedHillsBeef.com. Use the code BBQNATION at checkout and save yourself 15% on your order. Give Painted Hills Natural Beef a place on your table this holiday season.
It's time for Barbecue Nation with JT. So fire up your grill, light the charcoal, and get your smoker cooking. Now, from the Turn It, Don't Burn It studios in Portland, here's JT.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Nation. That's Barbecue Nation. I'm JT. My co-host and co-pilot, Leanne, is off working for PepsiCo this week, I believe. Her and her sister do these food styling gigs for big commercial television shoots and stuff. And so that's what she's doing. She ran away from home. But I don't blame her for that. We'd like to thank the folks at Painted Hills Natural Beef, beef the way nature intended. You can go to PaintedHillsBeef.com, check out their story. It's great beef. You can even order some online there if they're not in your part of the country. Well, we've got a friend of the show is back today, Stan Hayes, the CEO and co-founder of Operation Barbecue Relief. I always enjoy talking to Stan because they do such great work. Truly. We don't have that many disasters, if you will, up here in the Northwest, hurricanes, floods, that type of thing. Get a little flood once in a while. But in the Midwest, the South, and in other parts of the world, Stan and his crew are there. Hey, welcome back, bud.
Thank you so much for having me back on. I appreciate it. And I'm honored to, continue to be invited back.
Not a problem. You and I both like to talk, so it's easy to fill up the hour. OBR has been really busy. I follow you online, of course, and I talk to you a couple times a year and that. Yeah. But what have you guys been doing lately? I mean, last time you were on, we talked about the camp. Yep. And I know you've made a lot of progress on that. You've got a benefit golf tournament coming up. With some stuff. You're looking for a director of I don't want to say the title wrong, Stan. You can say it.
Yeah, it's really director of disaster. We call it director of disaster because they do more than just culinary, but it's a very, director of disaster culinary is how it started, but that position gets into more operational pieces than just the food service side. So it's a very culinary heavy position. We're looking for somebody that, obviously understands the volume but has some experience, not necessarily all disaster experience, but understands also, menu planning and scalability.
Right. That's a huge deal. I'll tell you a quick story. Years ago, I worked for an overseas firm, that bought, they bought a ranch and they did this big essay contest in their country and in this country. And they brought in it was about 100 kids. Okay. And I was the resident wrangler for a couple of weeks there for them. Cause I was a horse guy, right? The amount of food that they brought in, they brought in two semis full of food, Stan. And it was incredible. And then they got rained out. So they left it all and we donated most of it to charity and stuff. But that really struck a chord with me of planning and not knowing they could have had 300 kids there and they wouldn't have eaten all this food in 10 days. Sure. You know what I mean? So I think that's an integral part of it.
It is. And, we used to start out with rolling, a couple of semis. But, in our planning process, we're about 10 semis deep when we start looking, especially on a major disaster, a big hurricane coming in or, a big tornado that just happens. You mentioned, up in your area, I mean, really your area is wildfires and occasional flood. And wildfires and floods are very much the same in many ways. People sort of, go in all different directions. They don't normally go to one concerted little area like they might after a tornado hits or are evacuated from a hurricane. And the flooding, And fires can turn like that to where an area that is evacuated, today, by 10 o'clock tonight, they may be letting everybody back in, right?
Right.
So, which very rarely ever happens, after a tornado or a hurricane where they let people back in that quickly, unless it just didn't hit that area.
Right. Yeah, that's one of the kind of the strange things. Last few years we've had some pretty good sized fires up here in both Oregon and Washington. And they would have these zones, the red zone. And it was a green zone, which was fine, yellow, caution, red, don't go in there. And then there was another one, which is like you're not going home type deal. But that, like you said, that would change sometimes within just a couple hours.
Yeah.
And people could go back, and if they left livestock or whatever, check it out, get their goods out, be safe. But yeah, when you see we see it, of course, on television and stuff. When we see flooding, the aftermath of hurricanes, that type of some poor reporter standing on the beach with his leg chained to a concrete block so he doesn't get blown away trying to do his live remote there. I always feel sorry for those guys. You don't come back right away, but you got to eat. You got to eat.
You got to eat, I mean, let's face it, there's a few things that you have to have. Shelter is one, a big one, and food is the other big one. And then there's the resources and such as emergency resources or things like that. We're really only qualified in one area, and that is the food side. We can't help much about the housing. We can't, we're not an EMS type group or anything like that that can help, or even provisioning outside of the food side. I mean, finding diapers, finding things like that, clothes that people need. That we partner with some people around that time, that do those things. But that's not what we're really good at. What we're good at is being able to provide a good, hot, comforting meal.
How do you plan, make up an event? There's a hurricane coming to the west side of Florida. And you've got the guys at NOAA and the weather services, and they're saying it's a Cat 3 or Cat 5 or whatever. But how do you, when you first roll the semis, how do you kind of know what you're going to need right out the gate? I mean, you're obviously going to be there for a while so you can restock at some point, but how do you know what you're going to hit the ground with?
So, we start with looking at the size of the area going to be impacted. Obviously, Cat 3 to Cat 5 doesn't really matter at that point. When you're at a Cat 3 or above, you know there's going to be widespread damage. So really what we're going to do is we're going to be rolling in our first trucks that are going to have our main staples, right? We have a quick culinary to hit the ground running within the first 24 hours to where we can start putting meals out. Once we get on the ground, usually quick fire stuff, sausage sandwiches, things like that, are more heat and serve type of a approach. Then, but we're, like I said, we'll start out with a series of about 10 semi trucks that we know are going to come in. And we even our own equipment, like our command center. I always wanted our command center to roll in first, right? And I wanted it to be front and center so everybody saw it. But it's now one of the ladder vehicles that comes in because I need the food there on site. I need the smokers on site. I need the equipment and supplies. So those things start rolling in generally within 24 hours. We warehouse a lot of our own stuff. We have multiple warehouses around the country. We also work with Amazon, who allows us to at least store some vehicle and vehicle or vehicles and trailers at their main disaster hub is in Atlanta. So that's a great place for us, especially when you're looking along the Gulf Coast or up the East Coast side during hurricane season. So we're able to also move equipment around the different parts of the year. We know right now in tornado season that we're going to sit here and make sure that we have stuff, around the Midwest and across the Ohio Valley area down towards Texas, Oklahoma, just to make sure that we have coverage. But like our main food storage right now, freezer storage is Kansas City and Dallas. So between the two areas, Kansas City is really a smaller hub. We only have a certain amount of space, but it's donated space and freeze better than paying whenever possible.
Sure.
And then we're actually looking at moving all the stuff from Dallas to another warehouse space that we have on the Tennessee-Virginia border around the Tri-Cities area, because one, we already have equipment in that area. We already have a warehouse space, and the owner of the warehouse is going to build us. He's in the business of, cooler storage and things like that.
Sure.
He builds those things. So he's actually working on building that out for us, because we've ran into problems. We're a small client, and we're a client that doesn't generate a lot of revenue for them.
Right.
And meaning that, most of those warehouses get paid on the churn. They get paid on the square footage, but the churn is what really, that in and out is where they really make their money. So they don't like us when it sits there for 8 months and doesn't move. So we're, it can take us 3 to 5 days to get our stuff out of one of those big box warehouses, because we're a small customer and everything. So we've got to start out with the first couple of semis already in place. And so we're just working our way to the point that, at any given time in warehouse space, I have probably around 350 to 400,000 servings of meat.
Right.
And about the same amount on, maybe a little less on, like number 10 cans of vegetables and stuff like that.
Sure.
That way I can roll in with a couple of semis on my own and start the process and then backfill like you're talking about.
Right. Right. That's well, it's such a huge job. And, to know that, being a guy that ran a catering company for a number of years, on that very small scale, it's kind of mind boggling to think about what you guys are doing. We got to take a break, but we're going to be back with Stanton Hayes, who happens to be the CEO and one of the founding members of Operation Barbecue Relief. And Stan and I will be back in just a couple minutes. Please stay with us. Hey everybody, it's Jeff here. I want to tell you about something really cool. Heritage Steel Cookware. I just got mine. I do a lot of cooking, and it's got 5-ply construction stay cool handles. It's titanium strengthened. It's got all the great stuff. Just go to heritagesteel.us and find out more. You'll love it. I guarantee it. Welcome back to the Nation. That's Barbecue Nation. I'm JT. Leanne is off on special assignment this week. If you'd like to check out our websites and stuff real quick, you can just go to barbecuenationjt.com. You can find us all kinds of social media platforms between, Facebook and Twitter and LinkedIn and all that stuff. Leanne and I personally have them. The show has it. Kind of hard to miss us. Anyway, we're talking with Stan Hayes from Operation Barbecue Relief. Stan's been on the show several times before. I always enjoy talking with him because this stuff fascinates me from the logistics side and the cooking side. But also what I think is you guys really step up with helping people in need. I'll tell you this, folks, if you've not been under any, and I'm sure a lot of you have, but if you've never been under duress, real serious duress, and you haven't eaten for 36 hours, and you're trying to find a place to get a bottle of water because you're starting to dehydrate, Stan and his crew are the people you want to talk to. That's what I can say, because those situations are not pleasant. When you roll in, and you were talking in the first segment, Stan, you have, kind of the heat and eat type stuff like that. Do the meals get kind of graduated as time goes on? If you think you're going to be in a situation for 10 days, do they get a little more fresh vegetables instead of canned vegetables, that type of thing, if you can get your hands on them?
Yeah, the fresh vegetables are a challenge in itself, cooking time wise and finding them in the amount that we need.
Right.
If you're doing 25,000 meals or 30 or 40,000 meals in a day, Cooking from fresh, we're already got towers of, you know, of pallets of number 10 cans. If we started bringing in fresh vegetables, it would take forever. Now, we do some of the fresh stuff that we do try to add and augment with the meals as we go. We try to bring, as you know, fruit when we can get it. We try to add in, you know, even if we have to do fruit cups, right? Things that they can take with them, handheld type things, snacks. You know, everything from granola bars, something that, you know, at lunchtime that they can have, you know, a few hours down the road before they have, you know, and especially if they don't get back out and get dinner.
Right.
So we continue to work on that. And, you know, our big focus last, you know, year, 2 years has been around that, adding that fruit component to it, just a little bit more. The fruit cups are great because you literally can sit there and hold it for later as a snack.
Right.
You know, and we're even getting into and looking at what we can do. You know, we don't do breakfast today, but we're looking at putting together with the help of some of our partners out there, breakfast boxes that would be, you know, more, you know, shelf stable items that you,
sure,
you take out there. And again, it's not that comfort meal piece.
Right, right, right.
But at the same time, it still gives them something, you know. You know, whether it's a box of cereal, you know, today the milk today, the shelf stable milk today that they have isn't like the old days where you mix the powder up in the water when you're camping as a kid and everything else. It's actually pretty good, and you know, that way you're able to give them, you know, a little bit of normalcy. You know, a bowl of cereal in the morning, and you know. And a fruit bar or something like that is what a lot of families and people are used to. They're not, you know, not everybody's used to having, you know, bacon and eggs for breakfast or something.
Right, right, right. Yeah, we used to call that blue milk.
Graduating into, you know, today.
Yeah. Sam, when I was a kid, we called that blue milk. That's that old carnation stuff that they mixed up. It was god awful. But
when I was a kid and we were out there, we'd be out camping and stuff like that. You know, they wouldn't bring cartons of milk. They'd bring an empty carton and they would mix that up.
Yeah.
And then they try to get you to drink it. You know, like,
yeah,
that, I'd much rather drink the cold water out of that tap. Than...
Yeah, absolutely. So, how is the camp doing?
The camp has come along great. It has progressed to the point that, this week, the first building, the bathhouse, mm-hmm. construction is that they are sealing the concrete floors yesterday and today. We'll give it a 48-hour cure time after that, and we're now just waiting for the propane to be hooked up for the hot water, and we're ready to start rolling essentially with the bathhouse. So the tiny cabins that we already have that are down in the woods that we use, now people don't have to roll over and come to the lodge to take a shower or use the restroom or anything like that. They'll be able to walk to the top of the hill, you know, about half the distance, the distance isn't great, but I mean, just, it's a little bit more convenient.
Sure.
To roll in there. So I think the last thing after that, and they start putting the siding on, then we'll finish the ramp. We'll get finished for the ADA accessibility.
Right.
For it. But, you know, it's exciting. You know, the first cabin itself is about ready to punch and go through the punch list of, hey, you know, we need to touch up here. This isn't right. Or this needs to be moved or whatever it might be. And then we're going to be able to empty out. We already have the mattresses. We've had them for over a year. They were donated by the Tempur Sealy Foundation. Tempur-Pedic Sealy, you know, basically gave us a truckload of what we need. I think we're like maybe two mattresses short when it's said and done.
Yeah.
You know, but we'll be able to move those out of our shop, which takes up about 40% of the shop space.
Yeah.
And other right now has been all the wood, keeping the wood in a controlled environment, you know, to go in there. And we're using a lot of rough cut pine and staining it a nice golden rich, you know, sort of honey color, if you will.
Sure.
And so, you know, we got a lot, you know, a lot's going on, but it's moving, it's progressing. About, I'm down there every other week for construction meetings. So I'll be down there next Tuesday and really have an opportunity to see the progress. And it's amazing in 2 weeks, you know, what we're seeing.
And that's kind of the fun part too. When you get to go back and see the progress made, and you know, you kind of puts a smile on your face, I'm sure.
Yeah. Well, right now, if everything, you know, we don't have any major hiccups, the first week in June, they should literally, you know, be handing over the proverbial keys and moving their stuff out. And, you know, my team's been coming in and working on all the little things, you know, whether it's the skeet shooting range, the archery range, the garden area. You know, one of our volunteers who actually has been a recipient of the camp already, you know, a Gold Star dad, he's a, you know, hobby beekeeper. Yeah. And he's really grown in that hobby. And so he came up and brought us some more hives and brought us some more, you know, equipment to expand our beehives.
That's great.
You know, all of those things will be things that people that have interest in them, we'll obviously, you know, do. I mean, if you have interest in beekeeping, we're going to, you know, we're going to have that, you know. If you know, showing kids, you know, to me, showing kids where vegetables come from, just the basics of, you know,
yep,
what goes into a salsa, just almost is I think is more needed today than it's ever been, because, you know, we grew up with gardens in our backyard as kids and everything else. And most people have gotten away from that. Kids don't know that where a tomato comes from.
They, exactly. They don't
know, you know, these kind of things. And so we also want to be able to add at the camp those fresh vegetables and, you know, the culinary center itself. I mean, for those that haven't seen the video, they should go watch some of the videos on it, but our chicken coop is built into the actual, you know, built the actual barn that we're turning into this culinary education center. And the only thing we're doing is, you know, moving the door from inside what would be inside the culinary center now, you know, into the chicken coop to the side. But we're going to put in a nice big window so you can see the chickens in there. So
there you go.
See it.
There you go.
And you know, it's a vital part of it. Our chickens over the winter, when I had friends that weren't laying, you know, weren't getting, you know, more than two or three eggs a week, we were getting sometimes 18 eggs a day off of a dozen hens.
Oh, there you go. That works. Hey, we got to take another break. We're going to be back with Stan Hayes from Operation Barbecue Relief here on The Nation. Don't go away. This is great stuff. We'll be right back. Hey, everybody, it's JT, and I have eaten, if you've ever looked at me, you know that, but I have eaten seafood all over the world, and I can tell you there's no place better than here in Oregon and our Dungeness crab. If you want to learn more about Oregon Dungeness crab, just go to OregonDungeness.org and find out how to cook it, how to catch it, where to buy it, and the sustainability of what they're doing there in the Oregon Crab Commission. Check it out. Welcome back to Barbecue Nation. I'm JT. Miss Whippin is out in the world this week on special assignment, but we've got her captured again for next week. We'd like to thank the folks at Painted Hills Natural Beef, beef the way nature intended. Go to their website at Painted Hills Beef. Check out their website, their story. They've got an online store there. Great stuff. Do that. And also, I want to talk to you a little bit about pig powder. That's Leanne's product, invented by her father, Trim Tab. If you don't know what trim means, it's an air pilot term, you might say. It was voted at one time the best rub on the planet. So go to pigpowder.com. Leanne will make sure it gets to you. She might even autograph a picture for you, as I always give her a hard time about. But regardless of that, we've got Stan Hayes here today from Operation Barbecue Relief. When you started this 13 years ago or whatever it was, Stan, did you ever think it would get this big? I mean, we all have, when we start things, you know, we kind of think like, man, I'd really, you know, someday this, that, we dreams, but you've actually made it happen. You and your crew.
Yeah. So, you know, it's one of the, probably the top three questions that I get asked is, did you ever think, and Yeah, I know exactly where the question's going when it starts. And no, I never thought it would be this big. I never thought, you know, I knew we were making an having an impact in communities. I knew it would grow. I don't know that anybody ever thought it would grow to the point it is today. I don't think, you know, as you look at it, you know, our growth outside of the disaster into first responders and you know, what I'll just call those heroes that are always serving us. I think that has been a natural progression to continue to do good. Because when you look at the people that we're serving, you look at the volunteer group that we have, you know, they're the ones that really told us, hey, outside of disasters, we want to help our first responders, or we want to help the veterans in our community, or, you know, the active military.
Sure.
And, you know, so we listen to what our volunteers have to say, and as well as our partners out there, you know, where do they look at, you know, continuing to help?
How many volunteers do you have now? Or I'm sure it fluctuates depending on the situation, but
yeah. So we have over 18,000 people who've registered with our email in a database, right? You know, over the last 13 years. Of that, we have about 800 or so that have actually got through the full process to get, you know, have their background check done, you know, provide all the detailed information that we need. That's more than just their email address.
Right.
And I call those our engaged volunteers. Anybody that spends the time to go through there and have their background check done and fill out all the different line items that we ask for, right? They're truly the ones that we really rely on. So you have, you know, you have 800 that what I'd call the core group. And out of that core, you know, above that 800 of the 18,000 that we have, the other ones I call those, you know, being in the right place or the wrong place at the right time, whatever you want to call it. Yeah. Right. You know, they're ones that don't have the flexibility to travel. They don't have the flexibility to take long periods off. But if we were in their community on a Saturday, they may come out, right? They're interested. Right. They want to get our emails. They want to see what we're doing. They just may not today be able to be in that situation. And not everybody is. We understand that. But I mean, a good number of those 800 started out with that, you know, and now have grown to, you know, hey, you know, people that we've done additional training and education on. So they're actually leading different areas during deployments.
Excellent. Let's talk about the food. We've touched on it a couple of times, but do you get like the proteins, whether it's chicken or beef or pork or whatever, do you have to buy those, or do you have some companies that will help you out and donate some, or a disaster happens and you've got 20,000 pounds of pork? Well, that, if you're going to serve 200,000 meals over the course of time, that only going to take care of part of it. Do you ever get a phone call from a CEO or a VP somewhere and says, Stan, send your truck over here. I've got another 40,000 pounds of pork shoulder for you.
Yeah, we do. So let me start at the beginning of that big question is, you
sure.
Know, so one of our very first sponsors in the meat area was Seaboard Foods, Prairie Fresh Pork. And, you know, they have been with us now for probably 7-8 years at least. And every year they pledge to donate so much, you know, and, you know, you're talking about pounds. We talk about how many truckloads.
Yeah.
When we're going through that and really, they come to us when they're long on things, going, hey, do you have storage room? Because we've got a bunch of product here that, you know, we had to freeze. Because I mean, you know, companies like Prairie Fresh try to keep it fresh. They try
right.
to use it and get it from the factory to the stores, you know, without doing that. Once they freeze it, then that window that they have, you know, of, hey, how long are we going to keep this? We don't have an infinite amount. So that's one of the companies. We have a couple other pork producers out there. Holstone, who's a smaller, has been a good supporter of us. We've got stuff from Tyson before. We've got stuff from Smithfield. All of them have, you know, been involved. When it comes to beef, National Beef has been involved for the last couple of years. And we just did a project with them, last week. And so I expect that to continue to happen. It, beef is so much more expensive. So when you get a, you get a truckload of briskets donated to you, that's a big day for you because, if I have to pay for it, I'm going to go poultry or pork all day long because the cost per pound is, it's cost prohibitive for me to irresponsibly, pay for beef when poultry and pork are so much cheaper. And then, Mount Air and the poultry world, I'm forgetting some names. I mean, on the poultry side, Butterball is really the only one that we have a deal with. The other ones come through because they're more of a regionalized, producers out there. So as we go around the country, we know who the different ones are to contact. And believe it or not, where we get most of our ice is from poultry companies. We'll get boxes and waxed boxes that, case boxes that normally wings or legs or whatever go in. They will fill those up because they have their huge, the huge ice machines. And so we literally have had, poultry trucks roll in, but without poultry, poultry is really hard for us to cook because to get the volume needed, that's a lot of work.
Right.
Now we have a new, it's not new technology, but we have a new, cooker that is like, a charbroiler, conveyor charbroiler.
Sure.
That'll roll it through. And we've been testing that with boneless, skinless chicken thighs and we have to slow it down a little bit, unlike a burger, because we'll take burgers and run it through there and do things like we'll do that with a brown gravy over rice and things like that. We get far outside of just the barbecue world anymore because no one wants to eat a pulled pork sandwich every day.
Right.
So you take that same pulled pork and you put it over rice with a teriyaki sauce. Now you have something different.
Right.
We've progressed it, rice has been one of the big things that we've added over the years because we just know one, it's inexpensive. Yes, it's it's heavy, but compared to yield, it's pretty light what we can get out of it. And we're at full tilt, we're running, 10 tilt skillets at a time, which is about 10,000 servings when you're doing, just vegetables out of them.
Right.
So, we've gotten to where we can do a lot more and utilize the equipment in different ways. And so now poultry has started coming back in because we have these cookers that we can run it. I mean, two people can run this conveyor belt system, one person, loading it and bringing this, and getting the cases there opened up and just loading it. And one person making sure that they don't overfill on the other, so
that's
a very interesting, process when it comes down to it.
Do your people on the ground that are actually doing the cooking, because you were talking about this with the rice and teriyaki sauce and stuff, and I think that's tremendous, but do the people there, can they get a little creative? Let's say you had 100 pounds of frozen peas and you didn't know what you were going to do with them. Could they put that in the rice and put the teriyaki?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
We do a lot of that. We do a lot of mixed vegetable rice and stuff like that. We got pretty creative, when we went to Maui last year, we obviously weren't rolling semi trucks in, we weren't rolling stuff like that. So we partnered with restaurants over there, used our knowledge of how to mass feed and help the restaurants learn to scale to do things, and many of them kept doing it far after we left. We learned, and worked to really provide culturally appropriate meals, right? We were doing a lot more of, we were using a lot of pineapple juice with pork and with to add sort of that tang that they're used to, not just our barbecue sauce. We would add, we'd mix the barbecue sauce with that and thin it down. So you had those flavors. We had, I think we had rice on 90% of the meals that went out, the sticky rice, because that's what they're used to there. And you know, we learned a lot from that, in helping diversify our meal selection to be able to do that. But we have our volunteers when it's usually on the latter end of deployments, will work on menu development. So we try to continue to menu develop and let them give us some recipes that we may have to sit there and scale, right? You know,
right.
Not too many recipe books are written for a 40 gallon tilt skillet. So
no, not that I know of.
I had to go to my lead culinary guy and say, hey, Johnny, I need a recipe for 1,000 portions of Mexican street corn for an event that I'm doing. I need your help in scaling that up because I'm not even sure I could do the math correctly, you know. And he came back and we tweaked it a little bit because, you know, the 40 gallon tilt skillet, that's 40, you know, 40 number 10 cans.
Right. Right.
But when you're adding all these other things in there, I'm like, hey, we probably need to cut this back to 36 because when you're adding all the other things into this recipe, you're going to end up grossing this up quite a bit. So, you know, we play around with that and we get to have a lot of fun with it. They, like I said, they have a recipe book now on both the protein and the vegetable side. So we try to menu plan a week out. And by doing that, we can rotate, but we also know what proteins we need to have in. And it helps us with ensuring that we rotate that protein through.
Sure.
Sitting on the ground for a long period of time.
Absolutely. We're going to take another break. We're going to come back and wrap up the regular part of the show. And I'm going to ask Stan a very pressing question. I think you'll like it. Anyway, we'll be right back. Hey, everybody, it's JT. You know, I talk about Painted Hills all the time, and we always say beef the way nature intended, but it's more than that, because each bite of Painted Hills will make your taste buds explode, put a big, bright smile on your face, and whoever is at your dinner table will have a big, bright smile on their face, and you can thank me for that later. Just go to PaintedHillsBeef.com and find out more. You won't regret it. Hey, everybody, JT here. I want to tell you about Hammerstahl knives. Hammerstahl combines German steel with beautiful and functioning designs. They're part of the Heritage Steel Group, which also does their pots and pans. So go to heritagesteel.us. Check out the Hammerstahl knives. If you're really into cooking, I think you're really going to like them. Welcome back to the Nation. That's Barbecue Nation. We would like to thank the folks at the Oregon Crab Commission. I just did another crab deal, my version of a crab slider last week on TV here in the Northwest. And Dungeness crab, you know, they go from sea to plate, as they say. If you get a chance to eat some Dungeness crab out there, folks, do it. We're talking with Stan Hayes here, CEO of Operation Barbecue Relief. Millions of meals served. I don't even, is 11 million the current number or?
Yeah, it's 11 plus. I don't even know what the current number is. It's okay. Over 11 million. I know it's over 36 different states, plus the Bahamas now. And we're somewhere approaching 120 or so deployments.
There you go. So my pressing question is, when you were in Hawaii, did you use spam?
You know, we did not. We looked at it, but you know, you couldn't get that much. You'd go around the island. Now I've also never seen the variety. Like I was at Walmart, you know, picking up some supplies one morning before I headed to the site, and I've never seen so many different varieties of spam in my life. and at the McDonald's there, they do have a spam breakfast sandwich.
Yep.
But I wasn't brave enough. I just couldn't do it.
Well, I'll tell you, I always like spam.
I'm not averse to spam.
My dad, having been in the military a long time ago, that was a no sale for him. You know, he wasn't going to do that. But my daughter in college, she had a bunch of kids that went to school with her from Hawaii. And she came home one day and she goes, "Do we have any Spam?" Now, this is a kid that, you know, grew up eating kind of meat and potato stuff, but I never thought she would do that. I said, "Yeah, we have like three cans in the cupboard." And she took it, started making meals with it. I was proud of her. Anyway, that was a really pressing question on my on my brain.
Absolutely.
Do you get supports from the individual states or the federal government at all or anything like that, Stan?
Yeah, so usually it's through the state if we get any, and then the state goes back. The way it works is like with FEMA and everybody, if let's say you hear like, hey, the president's declared a disaster, for XYZ state, and they'll generally say, something like it's at a 75% reimbursement, let's say. Okay. That means that FEMA is going to, go through the process with the state. The state's going to have to claim all of, what's been done and all the money spent to be able to get 75% of that money back. Well, as a nonprofit, what we can do is all of our volunteer hours can be monetized. There's a whole organization out there that tells you what the chart is and how much a volunteer hour is worth and all of these things. So we keep meticulous records of, down to the volunteer themselves, how many hours they spent on site.
Right.
So, when they checked in, when they checked out, all of those things can be provided as support. So we can go to a state and say, hey, our volunteer hours may equal, 60,000-70,000 hours during that time at $30 an hour. This is how much this could mean to you. So what we want you to do is we want you to help us with, the cost of these meals, because in turn, you're going to be able to use not just the cost of the meals of feeding people in your state, but our volunteer hours to go back. And now that's how they could be made whole, because all those volunteer hours could help them well over that 75%.
Right.
To hit that 100%.
That's interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah. So, and a lot of the smaller states don't know it. A lot of the small emergency management folks have never really dealt in that world, so they don't know. So we try to educate them on how we can help them. But the big states like Florida, some in Texas, some up in the Northeast, the Carolinas and stuff, we've been well known in those areas. They know who we are. We have members of our team going to, these emergency management conferences across the country. So we have connections. Some states are easier to work with than others.
Right.
We're also not going to, we're not going to wait for a state to come and say, hey, we want you here. Even though Florida generally says it before we ever mobilize, they're like, hey, we want you to be on our floor, feeding team, or, Louisiana or something like that. So, dealing directly with FEMA and the federal government is just a very, very difficult thing to do. So we much prefer to work with the state or somebody else
and I understand.
Let them be the middleman.
Yeah. Would a state like Florida call you and say, hey, Stan, we've got Hurricane Izzy coming in, and would you be ready? Would you go have your... you kind of know the flight path or the travel path. Would you guys be staged at the Georgia border for us and whatever? I don't know exactly how you do it, but they get there and you got your first 10 trucks lined up ready to go as soon as they give you the shoot up the flare.
Yeah. So that is very much how it works on, with hurricanes, because they have enough lead time that they can come to us. They also know what our capacity is. They know that if I have every piece of equipment on the ground, I'm at 60 to 65,000 meals a day capacity wise. Generally, they also know what keeps me from getting there, because that's generally what I, what I harp on when they're like, how fast can you be to 60? How fast can you get me bunk houses for people to, stay in?
Yeah.
What keeps me from getting to 60,000 is supply chain, which generally I control a lot of my supply chain. But it's the volunteer side. If I don't have places for volunteers to sleep and stay, I can't bring them in to scale up to that as fast as they would like me to sometimes.
Right.
And that's my leverage with the state to be able to get some of those things. You want me at 60,000. Well, that means I got to have, you know, 200 people to 250 people staying on site, and you're going to have to help me get another 100 of day workers that are coming from the area.
Yeah. Did it, they give you a hard time about that ever? Or do they just,
Look, it's like a broken radio. You know, we have the same conversation over and over again, and they know who we are. They know what we can do. They know our capabilities. But you know, it's generally a new person in that position that,
yeah,
that knows that we can do it, heard we can do it, but they want to know what's it going to take for us. And, you know, the bunkhouses, you know, we roll in with, two of our own bunkhouses, our own bathhouse, and about four or five travel trailers for the core team to be in. So, you know, our bunkhouses, one sleeps 11 in individual little pod rooms, and the other one sleeps 13. So, you know, we're at 24 people that we can sleep. And then we have, like I said, some travel trailers. So we try to put our core team that's on the site there, are those guys that are going to be there for, you know, 7 to 10 days, you know, in a travel trailer and not in one of those bunk rooms.
Got it. But yeah, when you get there, you need 10 times that much space, though, for all your volunteers and stuff. We've got about a minute left, Stan. I'm going to hold you over for after hours, but
sure.
What do you think was the one thing, and you've been doing this now for 13 plus years, was there one event, one episode, one thing you saw on the ground that made you know that you were doing the right thing?
Oh, I you know, I think we saw it in Joplin. You know, I got asked this similar question, you know, and it is that heartfelt thank you,
yeah,
from somebody that you know could never repay you for what you're doing there. Thanking you for something as simple as a pulled pork sandwich. That when somebody, you know, there's something about having to ask somebody for food. It's pretty humbling, right?
Yes,
but
it is.
You're there and you're doing that, and you see somebody break down, and all they want to do is know who they need to thank for something like that. It's a very humbling thing. I you know, many of the people that you know, I call it, what's your why? What's your why? Why do you do this?
Right.
And when a volunteer tells me they haven't found their why, they're also one of the first people to come up to me when they do get it and say, I know what you're talking about now.
Yeah, absolutely. Real quick, Stan, website, throw out some information so people can check it out.
So the website is obr.org. And you know, you can go to that site and register to volunteer. We're actually going to be up in the Pacific Northwest again in June, up at A&A for Barbecue Fest, and we'll need some volunteer help up there. So be looking for volunteer opportunities. But you can also go to the website and click that donate button and help out. Follow us on social media. It's OPBBQ Relief is the handle on all the different social media. Watch my updates on the camp.
Yep.
And watch for Wishlist Wednesdays. Right now, our big push is helping us finish out what we need to purchase to finish out the rooms and everything once we get that camp built.
Excellent. Maybe this year I can help you at A&A. I don't know the dates yet, but I'll see. Anyway,
it's Father's Day weekend, the 14th, 15th, 16th of June.
Well, I'm probably not doing anything that weekend. So, daughter's gone. Wife's probably in Europe or something. Anyway, Stan Hayes, CEO and co-founder of Operation Barbecue Relief and friend of the show. Stan, thanks. Stick around for after hours. Folks, we're going to be back next week with another edition of Barbecue Nation. I'm JT, and Miss Leanne will be back next week, I think. Remember our motto here, turn it, don't burn it. Take care, everybody.
Barbecue Nation is produced by JTSD LLC Productions in association with Salem Media Group. All rights reserved.